Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
We're so glad you can join us. We are getting close to the U.S. presidential election, and the transatlantic community, I feel like, is abuzz thinking through what a second Trump term would mean for U.S.-Europe relations, and conversely, what a Biden victory would mean for how the U.S. and Europe could forge forward, mending the relationship and establishing an alliance for the future. And today we get to talk with Jana Pugliarin from the European Council on Foreign Relations, who, as a part of her Rethink Europe initiative, has done some really cool work, data-driven, that can help us shed light on the dynamics in Europe and how that's going to shape transatlantic relations moving forward. So Jana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Great. Okay, so what I want to do, and because we were talking just before we hit record about what a huge fan I am of all of this work that's very data empirically driven, maybe before we jump into our conversation, you can give us a little sense of what your project and initiative does, like the types of research methodology really that helps you inform and put together all of these projects that you've been rolling out over the last couple of years.
Thank you, Andrea. So with ECFR, I do a project that we call Rethink Europe, and it's data-driven, and we produce a number of different products. So one of our products is the Coalition Explorer that is based on a survey that we conduct among the 27 EU member states, among policy professionals, like people working in the administrations and ministries and in the parliaments, and also amongst think tankers and academia, so foreign and EU policy experts in all member states get to answer the survey. And it's about priorities for EU cooperation, and it's very much about perception. So how are the Germans perceived? How are the French perceived? Who is disappointed by whom about what? And now we have produced for the third time in a row this biannual study called the Coalition Explorer, and it sheds light on cooperation patterns in Europe, and also it answers the questions what the Europeans want to work on together, or in which groups they want to work on issues. And so this is one thing. And in addition to this product this year, we have produced another mapping where we worked with our 27 country researchers. So in every EU member state, we have a country researcher, an expert who does research for us. And he or she has conducted several interviews with government officials and also has gone through official documents and answered a couple of questions on the future of transatlantic relations, on EU-China cooperation, and on all sorts of things. And so this is what we have just published this summer. And before that, we did the so-called solidarity tracker. That was another idea which we had in the beginning of the crisis to track instances of solidarity throughout Europe. And there is a third product actually coming up with, which is the Cohesion Monitor, which has been published also previously. So I have inherited this project from my predecessors who have been working on this for many years now. And it's a lot of fun because you get a different understanding of European cooperation because it's really data-based, and kind of it's not so much about gut feeling. So, and that makes all the difference, I think.
It does. I'm a huge fan of the work. So if people haven't had an opportunity to look at some of the past studies you've put out based on that work, I really highly encourage it. But now we have the opportunity. You just recently had a new report out that's based on the latest round, I think. And so maybe we can draw on that in the course of our conversation. And I guess where I wanted to start with is kind of what's happening here in the United States. And I think at this moment, there is a widespread assumption that if Biden wins, that there would really be an audible sigh in Europe, that the United States would be welcomed with open arms. But as you find in your piece, it might be a little bit more nuanced than that. And in particular, you have some data that shows kind of public attitude, or not attitudes of officials, in France and Germany in particular that suggest that might not fully be the case. So I just wonder if you can talk through kind of what you found in terms of expectations in a Biden victory and how that would be received in Europe and how France and Germany actually looked a little bit different than some of the other EU member states.
Yeah, so we asked our 27 country researchers the question how their respective government would view the transatlantic relationship in case of a Biden presidency or a Trump presidency. And we gave them four options, basically. One was to broaden the strategic relationship beyond security and to engage also intensively on other issues. The second option was to basically consolidate the relationship but focus on security. The third one was to maintain good relations with the US but prepare for disengagement. And the fourth option was kind of to position the EU as a third pillar between the US and China. And we found out that in case of a Biden administration, the overwhelming majority of European member states would opt for a broadening the strategic bond with the United States. And so I was personally actually a bit surprised because there were all these reports and op-eds about kind of how fundamental the European disillusionment with the United States is and how long lasting, and that even a Biden administration could not be trusted because there was always the fear that 4 years later we would end up with another kind of heir of the Trump dynasty. And I think our findings show that there is this willingness from the Europeans to engage with a Biden administration and that the Europeans stand ready to cooperate. At the same time, it was striking to see that the data on France and Germany differed. So it was not that these two countries want to cut loose, but they kind of the researchers said that kind of the national debate and the kind of conversations with the experts led them to choose the option maintain good relations with the US but prepare for disengagement. And I think this is because the Germans want to cut loose or maybe not even the French, but I think that is based on a deep feeling that the US leadership role in Europe is shifting and that Trump is, he's a disaster from a European perspective, to put it bluntly, but he's the symptom and not the cause for everything. So that goes back to what Merkel has said in that famous Biden speech in 2017, when she said that the times that we could fully rely on others are to a certain extent over and that we needed to take our destiny in our own hands, and goes back to Macron's Sorbonne speech when he talked about kind of the unavoidable disengagement of the United States from Europe. And I think that is really behind our finding that the US has acted as the security provider and consumer of last resort for so many years, and that the Germans and French are of the conviction that the US is becoming gradually less willing to provide these public goods, and that even under Biden, kind of this tendency to do nation building at home and to focus on the Indo-Pacific, on China, and to kind of lead from behind in Europe would continue. And I think, so this is, basically this, to prepare for disengagement, I think is, at least from the German side, not a conscious decision to cut loose. It's more that there is this fear that the Americans would not be that interested in Europe any longer. That's my personal take on our findings.
That's so interesting, and thank you again for being on our show and going over these statistics. As much as I'm not a statistics kind of guy, I certainly appreciate the importance of statistics, but let me ask you your opinion and your gut on something, and this is a hard question, and so it's your own view, but also views that you've heard from other folks in Europe, other experts and people on the street. So Trump is he's the symptom, and I agree, and a lot of us here in the U.S. Andrea, myself, we're all trying to figure this out too, and so what is it then that if in fact he's the symptom of a U.S. shift, of a U.S. disengagement, of a whole U.S. different approach, what do you see in the U.S. society or in the U.S. that would cause that? In other words, one could say, well, you know, the U.S., you guys have always been a bit isolationist, and now that's really coming out, and there's a demographic shift and political shift in your country, and I think people want to pull in their horns, if you will. And I mean, what are you hearing in Europe, and what do you feel in terms of why there would be a shift, why there would be a disengagement?
So what people here refer to a lot is already the Obama administration, kind of the red lines drawn in Syria and kind of the non-action that has been following, then that the Obama administration, or the perception is basically that although there has been close cooperation, kind of the management of the Ukraine crisis, or the Russian intervention and the annexation of Crimea after 2014 was left kind of primarily to the Europeans to deal with. And so this whole idea of the US to not play, of course, the US plays an active role in Europe still and did so over the past years, but there has been a shift. Or take the Libya example in 2011, kind of where the Americans came in only after the Europeans couldn't finish kind of the mission on their own and came to the EU's or to the Europeans' rescue. So it is... Yeah, it is, I think, a sense that that the Europeans have had for a long while under Obama. When he first took office, there was a lot of talk about Obama not being a European president, and then that changed to a certain extent after the Ukraine crisis happened, because then there was this some sort of re-engagement with Europe. But then when Trump was elected, I think this was interpreted by many Europeans as... Yeah, a sign that the American public had enough of the blurb of the Washington elite, of the liberal internationalists, and many Americans actually told us so. So on their trips to Europe, that was what we heard very often. That and I can even understand this, that the American taxpayer cannot understand why he or she has to pay more for Europe's defense than the Europeans themselves. So. We hear a frustration with the Europeans that goes that predates Trump and also now goes beyond the Trump administration is shared by the Democrats. And so I think that we have reached a point where we really need not only to talk about burden sharing, I mean, we've been doing this forever, but where we have to be really honest and also where the Europeans have to leave their comfort zones, especially the Germans, and face the new realities. And I think especially in Germany, that scares the hell out of us. But I mean, we need to do that. And that is also, I wanted to add that when it comes to our findings. So I threw France and Germany in one basket because they kind of chose, the national researchers, based on their conversations, chose the same option. But I think here is a big difference between the two countries, because whereas for many French diplomats, and I've heard that in conversations, Trump is kind of a divine surprise or a kind of a blessing because he gives them the opportunity to push for more European sovereignty and autonomy and independence. And so for the Germans were very happy with the status quo ante before Trump, basically. And so the Germans don't have any desire to cut loose. To the contrary, we are afraid to be left alone by the Americans. And we are afraid that people demand more leadership from the Germans again. So whereas kind of the Trump presidency to a certain extent, and maybe that's a bit cynical, but is seen by many French also as an opportunity for Europe. I think for Germany, it was predominantly a challenge, and so there are nuances I think in the perception of the United States in both countries. And I would say that the Germans remain much more Atlanticist by disposition,
I want to get to the Franco-German engine too, because I know that was one of the focal points of the of your report, this recent report. But before we do that, I mean, one thing I find so interesting is especially you talking about the way that the French and German have talked about, you know, preparing for disengagement, and how that seems, in my view, just so kind of inconsistent with what you're hearing in Washington, D.C., large parts of the transatlantic community who look at a Biden administration as a huge opportunity to restore the relationship. People are enthusiastic and excited, and you get the sense that people, you know, that Biden's going to go to Europe and say, hey guys, we're back. And that there's a long list of things that the United States wants to work with Europe on: climate, China, Iran, malign authoritarian influence like election security and disinformation. I think there's a really long list that people in Washington would put on a renewed transatlantic agenda. But I have not yet really heard necessarily what Europe would put on that list and what its priorities would be. Do you think Europeans are thinking about that? Like, what would they want out of a Biden administration? What would they put at the top of that renewed partnership?
I think this is a super interesting question, because I think it has always been like that the Americans have basically put things on the table and wanted stuff from the Europeans, and the Europeans then basically, well, delivered or not. But it was never much proactivism from the European side lately, I think. So we have been reacting and but we have this conversation in Germany and Europe, kind of what to put on offer. And I think, so at least the Germans, they, and I mean, maybe that is not very much in accordance with our findings, but this, I mean, I think there is a preparation for disengagement, just because that is more kind of that we accept or that we take into account the long-term trends. But of course, there is also this readiness to re-engage and work as closely as possible with the United States, especially on security within NATO, because, I mean, for Germany, NATO is still the backbone of European security. And so, as you know, we are very driven by a kind of institutional framework. So we kind of, our modus operandi is through institutions. So we really, that is the big hope that the Germans and the Europeans have, that President Biden would come back to the multilateral table, sit with the allies, discuss, find joint solutions. And also, you mentioned climate. I think this is also, it would make such a huge difference to Europeans to have a president in the White House who believes in human-made climate change. And so there are a lot of opportunities, but I think the Germans are, at the other hand, also quite aware that not every problem will be solved under a Biden administration. And so we are well aware that, for example, on trade, kind of the problem of the trade deficit or surplus remains on the table, that also on the WHO, although kind of we would maybe be talking again, but that problems wouldn't go away, or Nord Stream 2 would remain a problematic issue. Secondary sanctions in general would cause a huge problem. And also defense spending. So that kind of the pressure on the Germans and the Europeans to deliver, and I mean, rightly so, that's my opinion, would remain. So, but there are these conversations, what to put on the table. And I think the hopes are, to reinstall a model of interaction that is based on mutual trust and also on dialogue, and not so much on bilateral ties like it has been done in the previous 4 years, kind of by the Trump administration reaching out to European member states on a bilateral basis. So I think that the hopes would be to work in a multilateral framework. So WHO, for example, or in the WTO, to get this conversation about multilateralism going again. And so we really think hard how we can be an attractive partner for the Americans for a Biden administration, because we know that we cannot just go back to the Obama administration and do the same stuff and kind of spend 0.01% more on defense and that's it. So there is a realization what to do. And I think we should think about what we could do in NATO as Europeans, strengthen the famous European pillar in NATO, and kind of to build it, to also to make it easier for the US to engage in Asia and to ease the burden. Here, I think it's on climate change. I think it's on new tech and digitalization, although this will be hard and not without frictions. But I think there is this agenda, and I think that I personally think under a Biden administration, this would be the biggest opportunity to revive the transatlantic relationship, because here the Europeans have a lot to offer. We are an attractive partner. And I think, as opposed to the Trump administration, the Biden administration would be ready to work with us and to see us also as an asset.
Yeah, I really agree, especially on that last point.
Let me go back to something that you said, which I agree with, but I wanted to ask you what it kind of looks like. So I guess whether it's a Trump administration or even, as you mentioned, if it was a Biden administration, you said that I think it's coming out of Paris that, you know, we need to prepare for disengagement. We need to prepare that the U.S. is going to be walking away. So what does that mean in terms of something practical within Europe? If you were a staffer for Macron or for the chancellor, and the chancellor turns to you and says, okay, lay out the things that we need to be doing now, because if the U.S. is going to walk, this is what we need to be doing. And the same thing would in Paris. What would those things be? I mean, I can imagine, well, we got to get PESCO on steroids.
That would be a very German answer. I think not a French answer.
So how would nations prepare for a disengagement by the U.S.? Even if it's a half disengagement, what would the European nations have to do?
Well, I think that depends very much the policy area you look at. Of course, when it comes to security, I think we are so dependent on U.S. security guarantees and capabilities that kind of strategic autonomy is ridiculous and kind of is not feasible, not even, I mean, in the medium term, I think it would take forever and be very, very cost intensive. But still, I think it's not so much about structures and procedures, kind of that is very much the German way of European defense. It's about capabilities and, yeah, to have some strategic enablers and some capabilities ready and to produce them, procure them collectively. So this is something that the Germans and the Europeans and the French and have been talking about for a long time. And I think I get your criticism that we have not really kind of hit the ground running, let's put it like this. But still, I think to work on the EU's capacity to defend Europe is very, very important. The problem here is that I think on EU defense, we are kind of deadlocked at the moment. So, of course, we have the strategic compass now, this whole process, but kind of, the problem is that with the multi-annual financial framework, the EU member states have just failed to kind of dedicate enough money to the European Defence Fund and initiatives like military mobility. So I think that we are not very credible, but that is, I mean, you asked me what I would advise as an advisor, I would say, wait, spend more money, invest, produce more capabilities. And work with the Americans wherever possible and try to keep them engaged in Europe and as much as possible. But on other areas, I mean, I think, for example, take health and take the COVID crisis. I think that here you saw through German and French leadership and the Alliance for Multilateralism or Multilateralists, I think you saw some initiatives on global health, where the Germans and the French really managed to get some support from a lot of other middle-sized powers, and where Germany has been very active. And so the idea about kind of European health sovereignty has become very prominent in the course of the COVID crisis. So this is where I see the Europeans being a bit more offensive, and also digital sovereignty. I think this is something that the Europeans have been working on quite successfully. I mean, and I would always argue along the lines that our former defense minister and now president of the Commission, von der Leyen, has emphasized, so become more European and stay kind of a transatlanticist at the same time, and try to combine those two, because ideally they are mutually reinforcing and not opposed to each other.
It's a great response. Thank you for that. And just a couple of remarks, and then I'll turn it back to Andrea, who's being very patient. But it's interesting. I was trying to answer my own question on this, and I would just say two things. One is, I think so much of how Europe prepares for a U.S. disengagement would revolve around German leadership or German-French leadership. And I think there'd be a squabble between Paris and Berlin and over, you know, who's in charge to try to pick up the pieces and lead Europe in a certain direction. Not that that's not already happening, but I think it would certainly be a big decider on just how Europe would prepare. And I do think on the security and defense side of this, if the U.S. were to disengage and the feeling was in Europe, we have really got to pull up our socks and stand on our own two feet, to use two examples of, and say that I think it would prove, and you've been kind of saying this, it would probably not be real workable on the defense and security side. There'd be a lot of projects to do things together and that type of thing. But I don't think they would work. And I think over time, you would see a lot of European nations splitting off, if you will, not leaving the EU, not doing a Brexit kind of thing, but saying, look, let's have our own bilateral defense agreement with the U.S. I could see the Poles doing that, some of the Central Europeans, the Balts, where they've kind of given up on a European approach, and they are throwing their arms around the U.S. saying, well, look, let's us, you know, I think NATO would probably continue, but it would be a weaker organization. The U.S. might even remain in it, but we would be there at a lower level. We wouldn't be there all the time with the SECDEF or with the president coming over for summits. It'd be a lower level of representation, but I think the organization would remain, but it wouldn't be as tough. And so I think over time, if the U.S. truly disengaged, I think after a while, if the European response wasn't up to task, I think nations would begin to split off and try to find their own way, either bilaterally with the U.S. or making peace with the Russians or whatever it might be. I think we would see a fragmentation happen. Anyway. No,
but that is exactly the scenario I think that Germany fears. And that is the scenario that, coming back to our findings and the data, that is the Trump scenario, basically. In case of a Trump victory, you would see half of the Europeans, and especially those at the eastern flank, those countries chose the option kind of to broaden the strategic bond with the United States, even with the Trump administration, Poland, the Baltic states, but also Romania and several others. Whereas the other half of Europe would basically prepare for disengagement. So much more countries in a Trump scenario would prepare for disengagement than under a Biden scenario. So, and basically the German nightmare here would be that kind of the French aim at strategic autonomy and they double down on their ambition, whereas the Poles and the Baltic states try to stick with the Trump administration and also being ready to bear any burden and to do any compromise. And so Germany is, as you know, the big bridge builder in the middle. So we always think of ourselves as the honest broker, as the country that keeps Europe together. And also the Germans, due to historical reasons, but also to kind of sheer business interests, we cannot imagine a Carolingian EU, kind of only us and the French and the former Western European countries. So this split, this rift that goes through Europe is already there, I think, and the German fear is that this gets even stronger under under a Trump 2 administration. But at the other hand, I mean, even under a Biden administration, I mean, I would really love to see the Europeans being more engaged and taking over more of the burden. So not sharing it, but maybe shifting the burden to the Europeans. But then I'm just afraid that when I saw our findings, and I think it's great that so many countries want to engage with the United States, but at the same time, it doesn't seem that they are preparing for any kind of disengagement or for a reduced presence, US presence in Europe. They seem to assume that the United States stands ready to embrace them and work with them. And that might even be the case, but we talked about these strategic long-term shifts and the pivot to Asia, and there is only so much money and so much attention that you have. And so I'm just afraid that the Europeans, in case of the Biden victory, kind of put the snooze button on all their ambitions to become a bigger player in the international sphere. You don't need to call it autonomy or sovereignty, but the ambition to be a player and not a plaything, I think, is independent from whoever is president in the White House. That should be our own ambition and goal to be able to decide about our own destiny. And I really... I'm afraid that a Biden victory would be seen by many as, oh, this is Obama 3, and we can go back to, I don't know, our coma and do nothing.
I hope, though, if it is a Biden victory, that there would be a lot of support coming from Washington to encourage some of those European ambitions. I think that there will be, among many of the transatlanticists in Washington, you hear, we fully support Europe's desire to want to do more, including on the security and defense front. And that break, I mean, with the focus of having Europe do more, particularly vis-a-vis Russia. And this was one of the questions that you had, or an issue that you addressed in your most recent report. And again, with the data, you show that Russia is, as it has been in the past, the number one foreign policy issue, but notably not for the Germans. And at the time that you took the survey, I think you said that it didn't even fall in the Germans' top 10 foreign policy priority issues. So I have a couple of questions that stem from that. Number one, I assume that was before the Navalny poisoning, and I wonder what you think that has done to push the Russia issue within the German foreign policy thinking. So that's the German piece. But then on the broader European side, there's a lot going on with Macron, who kind of favors more engagement. You called out in your report, like Italy, Austria, Belgium, Greece, Croatia, Bulgaria, other countries seem to be maybe more of the mindset with Macron that more engagement with Russia is needed. Then you've got the Baltic countries, the Eastern flank countries. So there are clearly divides in different ways that European countries are thinking about Russia, as they long have. But the second question, though, is like, then how much hope do you have, maybe with Navalny, that there could be a more cohesive, common approach to Russia in the next couple of years?
Yeah, Russia is the number one foreign policy issue, highest priority, still not in the top five EU priority. I think we should mention this as well, that kind of our coalition explorer shows that Europeans tend to prioritize internal EU policy areas higher than foreign policy areas, with the exception of the French, and that kind of the geopolitical Europe is still a far cry, and that we need a lot of work to do. Russia is very high on the Central and Eastern Europeans' agenda, but other countries, they couldn't care less, basically. And Germany is somewhere in the middle, but did not emphasize Russia as a priority. I think this might have shifted now with Navalny, but at the other hand, with Russia, I think the sense is that we have we are in that kind of deadlock now. We have a strategy that is based on deterrence and dialogue at the same time, and this is basically what the Germans continue to do. So whereas Macron saw the need to change this approach or to question that fundamentally, I think the Germans were still happy with the five principles that Federica Mogherini has come up with. And so they basically were very busy to hold the line on Russia and to keep the European consensus on Russia, which is a tricky thing to do. And so in our report, I was actually, I put it differently. A lot of people also working on Russia have always told me that Macron is very much isolated in Europe and that also the Russians don't take his initiative seriously because he cannot bring other Europeans on board. And I think in our report, we've seen that there are other EU member states that would go along with Macron, not many, but still. So the problem here is really, like always with the Europeans, that they have problems to speak with one voice. And in our report, you see clearly that kind of list of priorities is very, very different. So for some countries, it's a huge threat. For others, it's not. And Germany has always been busy to forge a consensus and to keep the sanctions in place. And I think this is still very much the strategy. I was personally hoping that due to the Navalny poisoning and the events in Belarus, that the Germans would shift their position a bit and that they would also realize that the balance they have found between deterrence and dialogue has not really worked, and that maybe now it's the time to get a bit tougher again with Russia and talking about Nord Stream 2. But I'm afraid that my enthusiasm was a bit too early, and that I mean, there is this moratorium that people here in Germany have called for is de facto in place because of the American secondary sanctions. But I think we are very much where we have been before the Navalny poisoning again. And so my hope that we do radical changes is quite limited.
As we've had our very good discussion, and I've just enjoyed this so much, I keep seeing repeatedly this one issue that is fascinating, and that is no one ever talks about the UK in all this. Now, the UK is not in Europe, I mean, UK is not in the EU, and the UK, I'm not sure if you come, but I mean, it's really interesting because now it's France, Germany. Which is fine, and I understand why and everything, but it's just amazing because had this been 5 years ago, the UK would be in the mix. And of course, the UK and the US coordinated closely, and so it's a whole different dynamic. So let me just ask you, in this whole thing that you've been talking about, and you might not have any data on this or anything, where does the UK even come out?
I have some. I mean, we have data on everything. Of course we have data. So we asked the Europeans on their priority list.
What do you think about the UK?
Yeah, exactly. And it was actually, I don't remember. I need to check, but it was kind of out of 20 policy areas, maybe it was 17 or something. I think a very few policy areas came even after the UK. So that really shows that relationship with the UK is not an EU priority. The Europeans right now are very frustrated with the negotiations. They feel actually also betrayed because, I mean, the UK, they made a deal, they promised something, and now Boris Johnson comes around and says, oh, we need to renegotiate everything. And this is kind of a the breach of international law, and the Europeans really are, to put it bluntly, a bit fed up with the way that the UK approaches this whole issue. And also, what I think is really a disaster, because we don't have many countries with a functioning army and many capabilities in Europe. So I think that if we talk about this kind of European defense stuff, you necessarily need to include the UK, but now even that has become difficult. That has become basically common sense in the beginning of the negotiations that, of course, we have to work closely together on defense and security and foreign policy. But now the UK has distanced itself from any EU initiative in this policy area as well. And so I think there is just this huge frustration. I think we can talk again once this year is over and we know the end of it, whether it's a hard Brexit or whether we find some sort of agreement. So what you've seen lately is a lot of talking about the E3 format, like Paris and London and Berlin working together on foreign policy issues like in the past and how to revive this. I know that the Brits are very much pushing for this format. The Germans and the French are very reluctant now. They talk about bringing other European partners in, like Spain, Italy, Poland, not to make this an exclusive E3 club. And I think at the moment, this is all just very frustrating and not leading anywhere.
So maybe as one kind of final question, like, so if the UK is out of the picture, and this comes back to my Franco-German engine question, which I think you address pretty thoroughly in the report, lots of dynamics have shifted, COVID, I think different responses to Macron's leadership style. It feels like there's a lot that's kind of maybe shaped the way other European countries look at France, look at Germany, and also how, you know, what they see as the potential for that engine to drive progress in Europe. Can you give us some of the highlights, or what were some of the key takeaways that you found in your report in terms of how optimistic you are that that Franco engine German maybe caught a little momentum coming out of the passage of the COVID relief, and what the prospects might be for the future?
So I think there are positive sides and negative sides. So on the negative sides, when it comes to the Franco-German engine, we saw clearly a huge disappointment by the French with the Germans. So Germany is actually the number one country that most French are disappointed with. The people that took the survey could choose five countries they were disappointed with, and every second French has chosen Germany. That was a surprise. And when I presented the report here in Berlin, really many diplomats were surprised, because they always emphasize how closely they are working together. And this is also, I mean, this is very visible in our report, that there is, that both countries see each other as closest partner, that they reach out constantly, that in every single policy area, I think with one exception, they see each other as the most important partner. But then we have this disillusionment, and I think that was largely due to the German not being willing and ready to engage with Macron the way Macron hoped, and the Germans advocating the status quo, whereas Macron wanted change and revolution. I think this has maybe to a certain extent changed after the recovery fund was agreed, and that was a Franco-German love feast. But in our report, you see that both countries have different priorities. So it's not, for them, on many issues, it's not natural that they work together. You see also that Germany on many areas reaches out to the Netherlands and Austria, whereas France reaches out to Spain and Italy. So you see the different philosophies. But what I personally found striking is that, I mean, Germany certainly is the dominating force in the European Union, but also very much appreciated as a leader. A lot of kind of, it's the number one country that the other member states share most interests with, that they think is most responsive, that that they think is most powerful. So 97% of respondents named Germany kind of the most important and influential country. But it was closely followed by the French, only 4 percentage points differences. So I think it's just, our report shows how impossible it is for Germany to work without the French and for the French to work without the Germans. So even if the French or the Germans would form coalitions with other European member states, it would still be impossible to work against each other. So they really need to work with each other in order to get things done. On the COVID crisis, I think that was very striking that Germany was seen as the country kind of being, are leading the most in the crisis in the European Union. But that the Netherlands lost significantly sympathy points. A lot of people said that they were very disappointed by the Netherlands. But yeah, you see that what I also found most striking was that although Macron has said that he wanted to reestablish or build a good relationship with Central and Eastern Europe, that he failed to do so. So you see this tremendous disillusionment that Central and Eastern Europe has with France. It's a huge gap. So that whereas Germany is very well connected with North, South, East, West, France is really very well connected with the South and the North somewhat, and kind of, but not with the East. And so I think that Germany and France can work together because they bring kind of different countries on board, and they could then, if they find a compromise on many things, then this could really be a workable compromise for the rest of the EU. Although talking about Russia or defense or the United States, in the report, I think it's obvious that it's not Germany and France as opposite ends, but very much Poland and France. So my new theory, I mean, it's not a lot of people have talked about this, but it's really Poland and France that need to get their act together and find a compromise. And I think then they would get most other EU member states on board.
That's a fascinating thing. And we're almost out of time, and Andrea is going to wrap us up. But I think everyone probably are wondering what the problem was with the Netherlands, where there was such disappointment with the Netherlands.
Yeah, I think because of a kind of their frugal opposition towards the recovery fund. So yeah. The Netherlands are actually super interesting because, Jim, you said, so the UK is out of the picture, but the problem here is who is the number three country now in Europe. You have clearly a number one, which is Germany. You have clearly number two, which is France, but we have a lot of competition for kind of the third place in the race. And the Netherlands actually have positioned themselves super strong on many areas. They are a partner for many other EU member states. They are seen as important, influential, easy to work with. But then again, because of them being so frugalish, I think they have just lost a lot of allies and friends over the COVID crisis. And this is also, we did a special COVID survey, and the Netherlands got all the blame, and not the Austrians or the Danes. It was really the Dutch were blamed for all of this. But this open race for kind of who's the third most powerful country in Europe is super interesting. I mean, we have Poland, we have Sweden even, and interestingly, we don't have Spain or Italy. I mean, you would say, of course, it's Spain and Italy as kind of the big countries in Europe, but they are not seen as leaders. They are seen as underperforming, punching below their weight. And I think if I were kind of an Italian or Spanish diplomat, I would think very hard how to improve my image in the European Union.
Well, that is fascinating. That is really, that this last couple of minutes have been really interesting. So thank you so much for that. But Andrea, over to you.
Yeah, this whole discussion has been fantastic, Jana, and we're so glad you can join us. I mean, just thinking from the US perspective, there's so many rich insights in this report and in all of the kind of different trackers that you've got. I mean, there's the big picture strategic takeaways, but there's also really useful tactical data points, who to work with on who and how they think about what issues and what the coalitions are if you want to try to move an issue. So, man, it's just, I think throughout this whole conversation, there's been so many rich takeaways. So we really...
Maybe you can put a link in the show notes or something so that people can maybe have a look at what I was talking about.
Give us the last plug here for people who want to find it. I mean, it's on your website at the European Council on Foreign Relations. It's the
Coalition Explorer, ECFR Coalition Explorer. And it's just, we have a page called Rethink Europe, and you find all our products there on the ECFR website.
Well, I'm going to definitely look it up. Andrea already read it because she's always ahead of me, but I'm going to find it too. I think whoever comes in this new administration who does Europe and NATO, they need your report at their right hand.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right, well, but before we wrap up, I know Jim loves to do his final last question. So, Jim, I'm going to turn it over to you to put
Andrea, thank you so much. This is great. And And Jana, I've been thinking about this question actually during this whole broadcast, and you know, you're a very well known, very well respected analyst and commentator and pundit, both in Europe as well as transatlantic. And so having you on gives me an opportunity to ask you, you know, in your career thus far, which is a rocket going up into space, you're doing so many great things. What has been your great truth coming out of your career so far? What is it that has really occurred to you that you might not have thought was the case when you began, and what have you kind of concluded, and how might that be something that people who are just starting off might be able to learn from and use as their career goes forward?
Thank you, Jim. I was looking forward to that question. I hope that you asked. So what I thought so much about over the last 11 years, since I kind of entered the Berlin kind of policy bubble scene, is that I have underestimated very much how hard it still is to be a woman in the field of kind of security and defense policy and NetSec. This is, so when I was studying, I had great professors and mentors, and I never had the feeling that I was kind of disprivileged or that I had a disadvantage. But now, ever since I ended up in Berlin, I realized that so often that conversations are dominated by men all the time, and how hard it is to get heard as a woman, and to get, I mean, I've gotten a lot of support, and I think it's really way easier than it was kind of my great heroes, Constanze Stelzmüller, Silke Temple, have paved the way, and they have done kind of the real hard work, and it's so much easier for people like me right now. But still, I have underestimated the uphill battle, the struggle, how hard it is to get people's attention, how hard it is to get their respect and to be treated equally. And it's not so much about participation in the panel discussion. It's the way, the people react to you. And another thing is that I have really underestimated how hard it is to have kids and a career in national security at the same time. So I think I would tell every young not to stop their ambition, but to really kind of, be aware kind of that this is not easy. I think this is a tough uphill battle still.
Wow.
Well, you're making it look good, Jana, I have to say. I mean, like, and just as you look up to Constanze, who we also love, you're doing the same thing for the people who are behind you too. So, I think it's wonderful advice. Kind of stiffen the spine, thicken the skin, and head down and keep working.
Thank you. And you Jana, too, Andrea.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jana, I'll have to say, I've heard that so much, and it breaks my heart. I want to cry. I mean, it's just, there are so many great women, two of them who are on the screen with me now, three, Carissa, who is behind the screen. Only thing I can say is this. When I started in the Pentagon years ago, I think Andrea was 6 years old when I started.
We just figured that out.
Yeah, we just figured that out. There were no women at all in the professional. This is 10 years before Corey Shockey showed up. So I started in the early 80s. There were no women at all. The women that were there were typists and admin, and there was one or two that had risen up from the admin ranks to become professionals, but they only reached mid-level. The only reason I say that is that there has been progress made, and I know it's hard to see it, and I know that what's happening in Berlin and with you might be different than in Washington, or, you know, there's lots of other variables in this, but it is there are pioneers out there, and like Andrea said, you're one of them. I can name off 50. We mentioned Corey, Julie Smith. They're out there and they're doing this. But for me, it just makes me so sad that watching it is hard for me too. And just know that we're all cheering and doing everything we possibly can. And I know it's 10 years from now, maybe we can get together for another podcast and see where things stand.
No, absolutely. I think there is a lot of things have happened, and there is an army of great women around me working on this issue. I fail to imagine how hard it must have been for people like Constanze. I mean, 20 years ago when they started, I cannot even imagine how hard that must have been.
Yeah, it's such a good point, and I'm so glad you raised it. And again, like, just kind of all working on it together and having wonderful people like Jim who advocate, and that will contribute and continue with the change. So glad that you raised it. It's a fantastic answer. And glad that other people have the benefit of hearing the shared experiences so that they don't think that it's just something that, you know, is unique to them that they're experiencing on their own. So anyway, this has been a really fantastic discussion. We could go on and on, Yana, but just thank you for sharing all of your insights.
Yeah, and I just want to mention that I would be very much looking forward to get this mug.
Yeah,
the famous mug.
Absolutely. We are happy for you to have it as well.
Yeah. And it was super pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that was great. That was really fun.